From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, filling in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, Christopher Walken, an actor who's fun to watch even when he's in a clunker of a film. He's best known for his evil or creepy roles in At Close Range, The Comfort of Strangers, The King of New York, and The Deer Hunter. He's currently starring in The Stepford Wives. Also, novelist and screenwriter Richard Price. His novel Samaritan is about a guy whose good intentions go bad. It's now out in paperback. And film critic David Edelstein reviews the latest installment of the Harry Potter movies, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. That's all coming up on today's Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. President Bush is in Italy today at the start of a three-day trip to seek support for a UN resolution on Iraq and to commemorate the Allied victories in Europe in the Second World War. Thousands of people demonstrated against the war in Iraq as the president met with Pope John Paul II and Italian Prime Minister Silvio Berlusconi. While in Rome, the president got the latest report on unemployment, showing that the U.S. added 248,000 jobs last month. NPR's Don Gagne says the president credited his tax cut policies for stimulating the economy.
The president said this is a good report, the third robust jobs report in 3 months. He says it's evidence that his economic policies, most notably tax cuts, are working. So he was very pleased to get that news while on this overseas trip.
The overall jobless rate was unchanged because job gains were balanced by more people entering the workforce. AFL-CIO President John Sweeney says the recent surge in hiring is welcome, but not enough.
The question is how long until we get back to where we need to be. We're still way behind the employment levels of 3.5 years ago, and this has been a painfully slow recovery that has left far too many people out.
Sweeney says there's still been a net loss of more than 1 million jobs during the Bush administration. U.S. military officials in Iraq say 5 American soldiers were killed and 5 wounded in East Baghdad today when attackers hit their vehicle with a rocket-propelled grenade. The attack took place in an area not far from the Shiite district of Sadr City. The Iraqi police are taking over security in 2 Iraqi cities as U.S. forces and a Shiite militia may be ending a 2-month period of clashes. NPR's Deb Amos reports from Baghdad.
A week after an earlier ceasefire broke down, Iraqi police have been ordered to patrol the holy cities of Najaf and Kufa, shrine cities revered by Iraq's Shia Muslim community. Iraqi politicians say they have assurances from Muqtada Sadr, a young radical cleric, that his militia will leave the city. The U.S. military will also move troops out of the 2 cities at the request of the Iraqi governor. This is historic, said a senior military commander, a sign the Iraqi government is taking over security, he said. The 2-month standoff cost many Iraqi civilian lives and ruined businesses in towns that had thriving economies from religious pilgrim trade. Clashes in Baghdad today between Sadr's militia and U.S. forces could undermine the deal. Deborah Amos, NPR News, Baghdad.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 47 points to close at 10,242 in moderate trading. The Nasdaq gained 18 points, nearly 1%, to close at 1978. This is NPR News. Saudi officials say police and suspected Muslim militants exchanged fire today in the Red Sea port of Jeddah. The running gun battle came after nearly a week after a major al-Qaeda attack in the world's biggest oil exporting country killed 22 people in the city of Khobar. More than 80 Mexican law enforcement officials, past and present, face the prospect of prosecution for incompetence in the decade-long investigation into the murders of young women in the border city of Juarez. James Bleers reports from Mexico City.
The 6-month investigation by a specially appointed prosecutor has revealed that police forensic specialists and other officials didn't properly file evidence or lost it, trampled through crime scenes, and lacked any coordinated plan of action. More than 300 women have been murdered or vanished during the last decade in or around Juarez, which is on the border with Texas. State prosecutors are now considering whether to charge the officials with abuse of power. Current investigators also say there doesn't seem to be a serial killer thread running through the murders, a claim which is being hotly disputed by human rights groups and bereaved relatives. For NPR News, I'm James Bleers in Mexico City.
President Bush said today that he's chosen former Senator John Danforth to be the new U.S. ambassador to the United Nations. Danforth is a Republican from Missouri who previously served as the president's envoy to Sudan, attempting to mediate among the factions in that country's long-running civil war. If he's confirmed by the Senate, Danforth would succeed Ambassador John Negroponte, who's moving on to be the U.S. ambassador to Iraq. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from T. Rowe Price, focusing on using independent research to find investment opportunities. T. Rowe Price, invest with confidence. Online at TRowePrice.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, in for Terry Gross. On today's archive edition, an interview Terry recorded with actor Christopher Walken. After his early roles in the film Next Stop Greenwich Village and Annie Hall, Walken won an Academy Award for his portrait of a self-destructing Vietnam veteran in The Deer Hunter. Since then, he's appeared in over 90 films. Right now, you can see him opposite Denzel Washington in the film Man on Fire. Next week, he'll appear as the lizardly suburban husband Mike Wellington in the remake of The Stepford Wives. Walken started his acting career as a child, but as an adult, he's played many characters you might not want your child to see, characters that are both menacing and oddly funny. On screen, his voice can be creepy or captivating, but always fun to hear. His eccentric line readings are tempting to imitate, which is what Kevin Spacey did on Saturday Night Live, imagining what it would sound like if Christopher Walken had tried out for the part of Han Solo in Star Wars.
Okay, Chris, whenever you're ready.
I'm captain of the Millennium Falcon. Chewie here tells me you're looking for passage to the Alderaan system.
Yes, indeed, if it's a fast ship.
Fast ship? You've never heard of the Millennium Falcon. It's the ship that made the Kessel Run in less than 12 parsecs. She's fast enough for you, old man. That sucked. I'm sorry. I need a minute.
Did you hear this impression when it was broadcast?
Yes, I did. He's a friend of mine. He does it in front of me.
Really? Does it make you self-conscious?
No, I guess I'm flattered, you know, to have that. It's never seemed to me that I spoke in an odd way. But I guess I do.
So you're not consciously trying to put the accents on surprising words?
No, I think that's I have my own way of punctuating things, and I think that's really more than it is. It's not so much the way I speak as the rhythm of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's true. I have my own punctuation.
What do you mean by that? Do you like repunctuate a script when you get it?
I tend to ignore punctuation, actually. It's not that I do anything different. I just take it away. And then when I read things, I try to have them begin and end more or less where they do in my mind, as opposed to, you know, being told where that happens. It's kind of more interesting to figure it out yourself.
So do you think when you take away your punctuation in a script and say things in an unusual way, do you think it ends up maybe sounding more impromptu that way?
Well, it sounds more like me.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, I think that's true. And scripts can very often be filled, I mean, not only over-punctuated by, you know, somebody wanting to make sure that it's spoken exactly the way they had in mind, but very often scripts are full of what they call stage directions, which not only tell you what it is you're saying and how to punctuate it, but it'll, you know, it'll have a line and it'll say in parentheses above it, he says despairingly, you know. Whenever I see that, I cross it out. Or if I see despairing, then I read the line happily. Or
let me play another scene from one of your movies, and this is King of New York. And this is, I think, more typical of the kind of role that you get, where you're the heavy of one sort or another. And in this, you're a drug dealer who's just come out of prison. And to let everyone know you're back, you stop in on some of the competition and tell them that you want a piece of the business.
From here on, nothing goes down unless I'm involved. No blackjack, no dope deals, no nothing. A nickel bag is sold in the park. I want in. You guys got fat while everybody starved on the street. It's my turn.
You think you're gonna live long enough to spend that money, you f***ing hump?
If any of you are tired of getting ripped off by guys like that, you come with me. I'm at the Plaza Hotel. You're welcome. You're all welcome. Enjoy.
Now, in that movie, you play the kind of character who can be pretty sadistic and is like amused by his own sadism, which is the kind of character you've played. And your characters all have this great verbal flair. I guess that's part of good writing for any movie. But I'm wondering where this kind of character starts with you, where your understanding of this kind of character comes from.
I don't know. I think if you get a kind of a ball rolling, and whatever it is, whether you're the funny guy or the romantic guy or the villain or whatever, if you're lucky enough to get that going, you could end up being asked to play that sort of person a lot. I think it's just an economic fact of life in the movies. Then occasionally you get lucky and get something else, something different. I've gotten to do a few musicals, so I've gotten to do different things, but it's true that I early on started playing, strange or villainous people.
Were there people who you observed as a child who seemed strange and villainous or who seemed particularly unhealthy or morally bankrupt who interested you and you observed?
No, and I can't think of people like that. But somebody suggested to me that it started with Annie Hall. It's one of the first things that I did. It's a great movie, and it's one of the first movies I did, and a lot of people saw it. It was a wonderful movie. But I played, essentially a suicidal character, a guy who wants to drive his car into traffic. And it's an interesting idea that maybe that's how I got on that oddball foot, you know.
Well, I'm glad you brought up that role. We happen to have a clip standing by. and this is one of Woody Allen's early movies. He plays a young aspiring stand-up comic. Diane Keaton plays, and he's like the Jewish neurotic urban guy. Diane Keaton plays the neurotic, goyish Midwesterner. And in this scene, Woody Allen's visiting her family home in the Midwest. At night, he passes you in your bedroom, and you make this confession to him.
Can I confess something? I tell you this because, as an artist, I think you'll understand. Sometimes when I'm driving on the road at night, I see two headlights coming toward me. Fast, I have this sudden impulse to turn the wheel quickly, head on into the oncoming car. I can anticipate the explosion, the sound of shattering glass, the flames rising out of the flowing gasoline.
Right. Well, I have to go now, Dwayne, because I'm due back on the planet Earth.
And, of course, in the next scene, it's pouring out, and you're driving a very frightened Woody Allen to the airport. It's funny, your lines on that about imagining driving into an oncoming car. I bet a lot of people have imagined that for split seconds in cars.
Poor Dwayne. it's that crazy thing where you anticipate annihilation for a second. It's better not to dwell on that sort of thing.
You've said that you grew up on the planet show business. You started in show business as a child. What were you, like three years old or something?
Well, real young. My brothers and I were in the show business at that time. And that was the birth, really, of network television. And it all happened in New York City, in and around Rockefeller Center. And they used a lot of kids, particularly at holiday time. I couldn't say that we were actors, but we were there. We were performers. In fact, when I do Saturday Night Live now, I had spent a great deal of time on that floor of NBC, the eighth floor. As a kid, I know all the nooks and crannies there. And, I know that area very well. And a lot of those shows came from within five blocks of Rockefeller Center.
You know, I think many of us grew up with the idea that stage mothers are like the mother in Gypsy, where it's like a woman who's really kind of controlling and possessive and manipulative, who really wanted to be in show business herself and couldn't do it, so she's living her show business life through her children. Would your mother have fit that image at all?
Well, I think my mother definitely had a passion for show business, but it wasn't, as I say, such an unusual thing for kids to go to dancing school and then get on the subway and go to New York and be an extra on some TV show. And I remember that the kids in those days, one wanted to be what they called a triple threat. That meant you could sing, you could dance, you could remember your lines. And people who could do that stood a better chance of getting the job than the other guy. And the pay wasn't much, but it was a lot of fun. And there were a lot of people who did that, and it was a sort of a community. I'm very grateful to that. It was an education for me that I couldn't possibly have had anywhere else. And in fact, I don't think I'd be an actor today if I hadn't done that as a kid.
Because you went to children's professional school and spent a lot of your time acting professionally, are there parts of what was considered normal children's lives that mystify you, that you were just like not a part of?
Well, it's true. I don't know much about baseball or football, or I can't hardly swim. The sports thing wasn't that present where I went to school, but I'm not sure it was for anybody who grew up in Manhattan. There's just no room to play football. The closest thing to baseball I remember was stickball. You used to play it in the street with a rubber ball and a broom handle. So that part of it was a little different. On the other hand, I can dance. There's a whole generation, I think, of people who grew up in the neighborhood that I grew up in, who are probably about my age now, who can tap dance. Going to tap dance class was not unusual, whereas now it probably is.
We manage to get little dance moves sometimes into your movies, like
I do. I try to fit in a little bit.
Like when you get out of prison in King of New York and you meet up with your boys again, you do, I don't know what the move would be called, but you do a few seconds of a little dance.
Yes. I've been told, in fact, it's true that there's almost always a little dance I sneak in. I don't do it consciously, but it does end up being there.
Yeah, sometimes it looks like you're about to go into your dance, just when you're standing and about to...
Well, maybe I did, and they cut it.
right.
Christopher Walken speaking with Terry Gross in 2000. A special edition of The King of New York is just out on DVD, and Walken is starring in the new version of The Stepford Wives, which opens next week. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's 2000 interview with Christopher Walken.
Let me play another scene This is a scene from the movie The Comfort of Strangers, which was written and directed by Paul Schrader, who also wrote Taxi Driver. And in this movie, you play an Italian who takes two English tourists under your wing and then uses them in your sadistic sex life. Early on, they can tell there's something not quite right with you, but they're nice people and they don't want to jump to conclusions. So when you invite them to your house, they kind of show up in a state of confusion. The man played by Rupert Everett is with you in the room that used to be your father's study when he was a diplomat, and you start to tell him about your father. In fact, all of your stories in this movie seem to start with the words, "my father." Let's hear this scene.
My father and his father understood themselves clearly. They were men, and they were proud of their sex. Women understood them too. Now, women treat men like children because they can't take them seriously, but men, like my father, my grandfather, women took very seriously. There was no uncertainty, no confusion.
So, this is a museum dedicated to the good old days.
Well, after you punch Rupert Everett in the stomach for no particular reason, then you wink at him. Was that wink in the script, or was that just a little Christopher Walken thing?
That was just one of those winks.
All your big stories in this movie start with my father, and your first my father story is, I think, about 6 or 7 minutes long.
Yes, that was an enormous speech. It's a wonderful script written by, taken from the Ian McEwan's book, but adapted by Harold Pinter. And the dialogue has a wonderful feeling to it. It's certainly a strange character I was playing, a disturbing sort of fellow.
Yeah, I think you once said that you found this character the most disturbing of all the characters that you've played.
I think that's true. I don't take things home with me that much. But he was, I was glad to get rid of him.
What was particularly disturbing about this character?
Well, he was just so twisted.
Having grown up in show business, do you think that having an acting career means something different for you than it would to, say, someone who grew up in a small town and dreamed someday of getting to Broadway or of someday making it to Hollywood? Because you kind of grew up with all of this.
Yeah, I think that my feeling about it always was and still is. I'm not as comfortable with the word actor as I am with the word performer. I've always thought of myself as a performer. If I'm a good actor, that's kind of a bonus. But being a performer has always been more or less how I think of what I do.
Well, Christopher Walken, before you have to leave, I want to end with a clip, and I was hoping you could tell us about making this scene. And this is from a movie called At Close Range, in which you play a kind of small-time criminal. Your son is Sean Penn. You turn on your son's... you shoot Sean Penn's, your own son's girlfriend, you kill her. You're a really heartless guy in this. And by the end of the movie, Sean Penn is so upset at all the treacherous acts you've committed against your own family that he's holding a gun on you, his father. And he's so upset, he might really shoot you, and you're not sure how to play it. Before we hear that scene, tell us a little bit about what went into the making of this scene and what it's like for you as someone who doesn't really like guns to be in front of a gun on a movie set.
Yes, well, this story is based on a real family and, it's a terrible, sad story. When we shot this scene, I think I know what you're referring to. I've said it before, but I had a gun pointed at me, and at one point they switched the guns, and that was enough to put me in a panic. I didn't know really what was going on, although everything was being kept very safe behind my back. just being in the dark about it got me into a huge anxiety attack. Anyway, that on film, you can see that. That's about all I can tell you.
And the other thing I like about the scene is that you're a character who's so incapable of being sincere. I mean, you're trying so hard to say to your son, I love you, and it just it just won't come out in a sincere way at all.
Yeah, well, I tried to be sincere.
Tried and failed, though, wouldn't you say?
Yeah, I guess so. But yeah. That's in character.
Exactly. Christopher Walken, it's been a real pleasure. Good luck with your new film, and please make a musical one day.
Thank you, and it's always a pleasure to listen to NPR.
Oh, well, thank you for saying
and
that.
And your program.
Is the gun used to kill Terry?
I never did nothing to Terry.
Whoa! Whoa, wait! Is this gun used on everybody, on me? Family gun, Dad.
Jesus. Put that down. I've seen you.
You're gonna die. I know one thing clearer than I've ever known anything in my entire life, except that I loved Terry before you killed her. And that is that you're gonna die.
You got the guts to kill me? I'm your blood. I'm your family.
You're not my family, not anymore.
Yeah, you're crazy. Crazy, gone crazy.
Nope.
Listen!
What?
I know how it is. Cops got you in there, get your head all f***ed up. I know how that is.
My mind's simple, Dad.
Before they got you twisted, you must have known something, you must have felt it. I gave you money, I gave you a car, I took you in. But don't that mean something?
Means what? Means what?
It means I got feeling for you.
What the f- feeling?
I care. What do you... I love you. What? Is that what you want to hear? I love you.
Yeah.
Mother f-
I love you too, Dad.
Christopher Walken with Sean Penn in a scene from the film At Close Range. He spoke with Terry Gross in 2000. Walken's newest film, a remake of The Stepford Wives, opens next week. I'm Dave Davies. This is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble, publishers of Portable Professor, a new series of university-quality courses on compact disc, available at Barnes & Noble stores and online at bn.com, and from Delta Trade Paperbacks, publisher of Easter Island, a novel of two women on parallel quests, decades apart, and the remote island that connects their stories, by Jennifer Vanderbees. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Richard Price. His novel Samaritan is now out in paperback. It's about a guy who, like Price, grew up in a housing project and has made a lot of money as a writer. He moves from L.A. back to New Jersey to help out some of the people in the projects he left behind. Also, David Edelstein reviews Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, sitting in for Terry Gross. Richard Price has written several novels which have been adapted into films, including Clockers, about crack dealers and cops, and The Wanderers, about street gangs in the Bronx, where Price grew up. Price also wrote the screenplays for the films Sea of Love, Mad Dog and Glory, and The Color of Money. More recently, he's written a number of episodes for the HBO series The Wire. His latest novel, Samaritan, comes out in paperback next week. It's about a guy who, like Price, grew up in a housing project and became a successful writer. The character in the novel, Ray Mitchell, has made a lot of money in L.A. writing for TV. After September 11th, Ray returns to New Jersey to be near his daughter. He also returns to his old neighborhood in the hopes of sharing some of his success by teaching at his former high school. Terry spoke with Richard Price last year. He began with an excerpt from Samaritan. Ray is teaching his first creative writing class, trying to convince a room of skeptical kids they each have stories to tell, and he's beginning to think that this teaching thing just might work.
This is great, great. Okay, this class, forget it, okay? Don't even think of it as creative writing. It's just stories. The writing assignments, stories, telling stories. Can somebody wake this guy up? One of the girls punched the boy Jamal, whose forehead was resting on the table. Ray, so happy now, stories his lifelong lifeline. To his daughter, to romance, to himself. Stories the ballast, the crash cart, the air. And the thing is, what are you, Hopewell Projects kids? Neighborhood kids? Oh man, nobody out there knows what you know. And what you may think of as everyday, as boring, that's like, nah, that's me. When I want to read something, a book, a story, a newspaper article, I'm thinking time is tight. Why should I read this? What does this individual have to tell me that I don't already know? He then checked himself, something off in the message. Not that what you write has to be a showstopper, mind-boggling, or, you know, can you top this? All I am saying is, believe me, you're all so much more interesting, so much more special than you might think. So every week, you're going to write me a few pages. Doesn't have to have a beginning or an end. Just some kind of snapshot, word picture. Bring it in and read it to the class, or I'll read it for you and we'll talk. Questions? Jamal, the sleeper, raised his hand. Does spelling count? The girl with the big framed glasses, Myra, clucked her tongue in irritation. Spelling is good. It's good to have spelling. His disappointment in the question was neutralized by this Myra. Something cooking there. Can we write in pencil? Pencil, pen, blood, as long as I can decipher it. Do they have to be true? Fool me.
Richard Price, do you think that this was a good lesson that he was delivering?
Worked for me.
Yeah, I figured.
I mean, you have. That's how I started. You know, I mean, you start writing, you know, and you look around at your life, and you're 18, and the whole idea of write about what you know can be deadly for somebody who doesn't even vote yet. So what worked for me, and I think what worked for some of my students over the years, was reaching back into the family mythology and not being, you know, focused on the fact that all you know is that you miss your girlfriend over Thanksgiving vacation and you hate being with your parents.
One of the things Ray is up against as a teacher is that the kids are giving him these kind of prepackaged stories. Talk a little bit about the stories he gets from the students and how that connects with what you found when you were teaching people who had really interesting lives, but that wasn't what was coming back at you at the stories that were writing.
Well, what happens is that, you know, when you're trying to get kids to write, or trying to get anybody to write who's not a serious writer, rather than think about what's meaningful to them, they try to anticipate what would be meaningful to you. And so the source is always coming from the outside. What does this guy want to hear? What'll get me an A? How do I get this homework assignment as quick as I can? And the irony is that, you know, so they go to television for their stories, or they go to sort of crummy books that they've read, you know, for ideas, when in fact, you know, there's diamonds in the backyard. The minutia of their everyday life is where all the jewels are. And repeatedly I've had to sit kids down and say, why are you writing this? Tell me about yourself. Tell me, your father's a black fireman in a white suburban town? Well, why on earth are you writing about people sniffing angel dust in the South Bronx where you've never been?
Ray is separated from his wife. And right. When he comes back to New Jersey, he hooks up with his daughter again. But he's very self-conscious around her and realizes he's treating her like a first date. What gave you that image?
Oh, I got a couple of daughters. I use them for practice. it's just, you know, I find myself, I mean, sometimes with my kids, the bad parent part of me is the part of me that feels like it's running for office and needs their votes and sort of like can cater, you know, to what they would like as opposed to doing the more difficult stuff, which is to say, no, you can't do that. You know, and there's a certain weakness in me that I have to fight to be a parent. I mean, it's, you know, it's a big, you know, cliche to say, you know, don't be a friend, be a parent. You know, there's plenty of time for friendship when they turn adult themselves. Right now, they need yes and no. They need guidance, you know. And but basically, I have to struggle with the fact that what I really want them to do is adore me, you know. And I'm running for office, you know. And I catch myself, and I'll pull back, but it's hard work.
There's a scene where Ray takes his daughter, his 13-year-old daughter, to the shopping mall and tells her, today a dollar's like a penny. You can spend anything. You can buy anything. And he expects he's really going to be a hero to her, but she gets really angry and sullen and kind of throws on the floor the things that he's bought her. What's that about?
It's about how easy it is to us underestimate the perceptiveness and intelligence of children. And how they can read you like a comic book and have been all their lives if they're yours. And any kid, if not, you know, even if they're not able to put it in words, knows exactly the weaknesses of their parents and knows exactly the strengths of their parents. And it so rarely has anything to do with what comes out of the parents' mouth. I mean, you know, I've been in therapy for, I think, 3,427 years. You know, I've put 11 Shrinks kids through Bennington already, I think. But, you know, and so when I'm talking to my kids, I know exactly what to say to sound, you know, like, you know, sharing and caring and, you know, saying, making the right noises and this and that. But I think what the kids do is they smell you. They don't even listen to what's coming out of your mouth. They look you right in the eye or they arch their nostrils and they know what you really want, what you really value, what you really need. So this daughter would know that Ray, if the easiest way for Ray to be giving is to give something, to literally, and they're in the mall, which is the crucible. And the kid flips out. She doesn't want any more belly button rings. She doesn't want any more, like, skin lotion. She doesn't want anything. She just wants him to shut the hell up.
No, you know, Ray gets this terrible head injury. He's hit over the head with a vase. And, you know, who did it and why they did it is the mystery in the book. Usually in detective stories, the detective gets hit over the head, usually with a gun. He's knocked unconscious, and he awakes with a terrible headache that goes away in a few hours. Whereas, you know, Ray is, he's in serious jeopardy after getting knocked on the head with his vase. And the jeopardy continues because the headaches can come back. There can be long-term consequences. I was wondering if you were thinking a lot about how different a concussion can be in real life from the way it usually is in crime fiction.
Not really. I mean, I was basically thinking of, you know, I just went to a couple of doctor people, friends that I know, and said, give me a real bad concussion. You know, which they proceeded to do. I just wanted enough to know. I mean, basically, the pain that Ray has to live with and the tentativeness of his recovery, he's been taught a lesson. He knows who did this to him, and he knows that down the line it could cost him his life or it could cost him the use of the right side of his body or something like that. And he doesn't want revenge. He doesn't want this person arrested. He's learned something. And what's driving the detective crazy is that there's a certain amount of shame in what he's learned, and that's why he's not telling her. He's protecting somebody, and what she's picking up from him is shame. And when a detective picks up reticence in a victim, they're thinking that here's a person who's more afraid of the truth coming out than of getting justice. That means that this person is hiding something pretty bad. So, of course, the first thing she thinks of has to do with deviant sexuality, pederasty, drug habit, gambling addictions. She goes through a whole checklist of reasons why people would rather live, you know, with their injury, you know, than see justice sought. But it's something greater and more subtle than any of that. And each book is supposed to be about the education of a character. Well, I mean, they both become educated during the course of the investigation.
Richard Price speaking with Terry Gross. His latest novel, Samaritan, comes out in paperback next week. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to Terry's interview with Richard Price. His latest novel, Samaritan, is out in paperback next week. It follows Ray Mitchell, a TV writer who, after September 11th, moves from L.A. back to New Jersey, where he grew up.
Now, I think you're in the process of writing a screen adaptation of your new novel, Samaritan, yes?
Not if I can help it. I'm supposed to. I mean, to write a script of your own book, I always say it's like just because you're a dentist, that doesn't mean you have to do your own root canal. I mean, it's a nightmare. You have to sort of debride and tear apart this thing, and you know every word of the 400 pages, and your job now is you got to make it into a 110-page singing telegram, and it's all like going up into the attic to find something when you open up a book. You know, to find material to write a screenplay. You come down 3 days later with a whalebone corset on, all your old baseball cards, you know, and your great Aunt Fanny's hat. And you now have a 9,000-page screenplay because it's your book and you love every word and you just can't do it. You don't have the discipline. You're not ruthless enough.
So you're not going to do it yourself? You're going
to
have somebody
else
do it?
I'm supposed to do it myself. I'm scheming to, like, try to convince the producer to give it to somebody else and let me write a second original. If I have to, I will, but I'd rather not. Life's too short.
Were you happy with the Clockers adaptation?
Not really. I mean, there were very good things in it. I mean, Spike Lee is an artist. He's a terrific visual artist, and there was a terrific visuality to it. There were some wonderful things in some of the performances. By and large, it's not the movie that I would have made, but then again, I'm not a filmmaker.
So was the adaptation that was used one that you had written?
Well, it's what I had written and what Spike rewrote. He wrote on top of me. And there was an interesting thing. He said something to me. I had seen his draft of my draft, and I was horrified. And I said, told him so. I just said, this is like cheesecloth. I mean, there's nothing here. And he said to me, and I've never forgotten this, he said, Richard, you're a writer, you're a screenwriter. When you're done with this script, you're gone from the film project. So you put in everything but the kitchen sink. It's like leaving notes all over, for the cleaning lady. You know, do this, do that, right before you, and you're gone. Me, when I write this, I'm the director. So the script is basically notes to myself. I don't have to show this to a director. I am the director. All I need to write down is things I don't want to forget.
When was the last time you picked up one of your early novels, The Wanderer's Ladies' Man, even The Breaks?
When was the last time?
Mm-hmm.
Never. All I see when I look back at this stuff I've written, especially before Clockers, is what I got away with. You know, I never see anything. I'm reading this stuff, and I can't see how it got published. All I can see is the mistakes I've made, which is probably okay. If I thought that this is as good as it's going to get, then I haven't learned anything. But now that my kids are, teenagers, they've both read a few books of mine, and when I was writing these books, I was in my early 20s. The idea of having children is I might as well be a cowboy or something. It just seemed like science fiction to me to have children, when I was writing. And now all of a sudden I've got kids that are about 5 or 6 years younger than I was when I wrote The Wanderers, and they're starting to read it, and they look to see where I am, and they have to read it on the slide, because if I know that they're reading it, I'm going to sneak up behind them and start screaming out, don't read that paragraph. I didn't know you were going to read that someday. because there's all this, perversity in it, which, when I wrote it, was just exuberance. But now I've, my own kids are reading this, and it's mortifying. And they both say, Dad, go away. You go read Stephen Crane or something. I am going to read this book, okay? I'm not going to tell you when I'm reading this book. If I see you coming, I'm going to put the book down. And I go, okay, I'm leaving. And then I, like, sort of crawl back into the bedroom through the other way, sneak up behind them and try to peek over their shoulder and see what part they're at. And next thing you know, my hand comes across over their shoulder. It's like, don't read that page, and I have a heart attack because I didn't know I was in the room. I mean, it's a wonderful thing. It's like, you know, I have a 16-year-old daughter who's reading Samaritan now, and she doesn't read an awful lot. You know, she's a good writer, and she reads what she reads, but, you know, reading is not one of her major pastimes. And she just said, hey, Dad, you're like a really good writer, you know, and it just felt so nice that she said that.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Richard Price, and his new novel is called Samaritan. Do you go back to your old neighborhood much?
Well, I went back to my old neighborhood. That's how this book started. I went back to the projects in the Bronx, and I went back with this detective who I based the Nerys Ammons character on, because this was the extreme corner of her precinct's jurisdiction.
So this would be the projects in the Bronx where you grew up that The
right,
Wanderers
the
is based
project.
On, which is
right.
your novel about street gangs in the South Bronx.
Right. I mean, and I went back. But, you know, the thing is, you can spend your whole life writing about the same people and the same things, and it's okay. You don't have to go anywhere else, because what changes is you. And it's basically a lifetime of refining a vision. I mean, I would never, you know, put myself in the same category as Faulkner. But, I mean, obviously, he's the example everybody brings up, that little county in Mississippi. For me, it would be the Parkside Projects in the Bronx. The bricks will stay the same. I'm the thing that's going to change.
Well, not only have you changed when you go back to the projects where you grew up, the projects have changed. I'm sure the neighborhood's
right.
changed. The people living in the projects have changed. What are some of the
ways
it's
changed?
Well,
that was the big shock about Clockers, which is that I'd grown up in a projects, but I'd grown up at a time in the 50s and the early 60s. It was before drugs and before Vietnam, and people stayed there because it was clean, good, affordable housing, and you could save money to send the next generation on to college so that generation wouldn't have to return to the projects. And that all changed in the late 60s and early 70s. And when I had gone from the Wanderers, which was about the projects in the 60s, and all of a sudden it's the 1980s, and I'm doing research for Sea of Love, the Al Pacino movie, and I go with a bunch of cops back to a housing project in Jersey City, which is very much, you know, architecturally at any rate, like the projects that I had grown up in, except it was a place that it looked like hell. I had never, I felt like I was in a tiger pit. I'd never seen anything so dire and desperate in my life. And I found myself feeling, wanting so badly to understand what happened in this project, or trying to reconnect to this project, and that's what Clockers came out of. But it's just ironic. It's like I've been writing for 30 years, and it seems like I started out with housing projects, and I'm still back at the original project that The Wanderers came out of.
You know, in your early novels, like The Wanderers, The Breaks, Blood Brothers, it was easy to see the main character as being your surrogate. In your later novels, like Freedomland and Clockers, it didn't seem to really be directly about you in any way, although I'm sure there are experiences based on ones you had. But in your new novel, Samaritan, it's easier to see Ray as a character who shares some of the experiences that you had as being, in some level or another, like your surrogate. Do you feel like you took a break from yourself and then came back to yourself?
Yeah, well,
again?
What happened is, you know, my first four books in some way were self-referential, and there I was, like 32 years old, with four autobiographies. I mean, even my therapist was going into a coma, you know. And so I just had to stop, and that's why I got into screenwriting, because I wanted to keep writing, but I just didn't want to have to keep writing about myself. Became a hired pen, and for all the bad things you can say about Hollywood, it did teach me that I can write about people that are not me, and, you know, pull it off. So I did that for 8 years, and when I got back to novels, you know, I still was afraid of going back into examining my own navel. But, you know, I got, for personal reasons, got involved in the world of, you know, Clockers and Freedomland, where there was nobody like me. Samaritan is sort of like a return to thinking about myself a little bit, because I think it's safe now. I mean, 20-odd years have passed. And, you know, like I said, I've been married that time. I have two children. I didn't have any kids. And I think my life has changed enough that I feel like I have some things to say that are clean and fresh, at least about myself, to myself. And I think, once again, I feel a little bit like I am valid grounds for literature again, hopefully.
But writing about a character like yourself, when you have a wife and children, can be complex, too, because they might see some of the characters as being similar to them, or they might see some of your character's thoughts as being like your thoughts. And here's like a sensitive one. Your character is thinking about the difficulty of remaining monogamous in marriage because you get to know the other person's body so well. It's kind of like making love to yourself.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it's not something a wife would really want to read.
Well, but, you know, it's, you know, hey, I mean, they do call it fiction. I mean,
yeah, exactly.
You know, somebody
knows you.
Help. I mean, somebody, you know, listen, somebody knows you.
Exactly.
And they know
right.
what you do for a living.
Exactly.
And they know what it's like to be with you, and they know how you feel about them. And you would hope that they can read something, be they your spouse or your kids, and know what artistic license is.
Right. Well, Richard Price, thank you so much for talking with us.
You're welcome.
Novelist and screenwriter Richard Price speaking with Terry Gross. His novel Samaritan comes out in paperback next week. Coming up, the latest Harry Potter movie. This is Fresh Air. The Mexican director Alfonso Cuarón is best known to American audiences for his sexy coming-of-age hit Y Tu Mama También. His new film follows another set of young people. It's based on the third book of the Harry Potter series, Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban. David Edelstein has this review.
What a drag it was 3 years ago when Harry Potter and the Sorcerer's Stone became a movie, and the director turned out to be the genial Hollywood yes-man Chris Columbus. It was a twinkly, Christmassy, family picture, with none of the subversive energy out of which this series was created. I don't mean that J.K. Rowling is some kind of punk agitator, but these books are angry. They're written in a rage against a fascist strain in the blue-blood English upper crust and their clueless allies, the vulgarly snobbish middle-class muggles. Every book begins with the lonely, friendless, maltreated orphan Harry shut in his room, practicing magic in secret, just as Rowling must have shut herself away to summon the pagan fury to forge each new adventure. The first sign that Harry Potter and the Prisoner of Azkaban is different is the way the new director, the Mexican Alfonso Cuarón, shoots the first scene, in which we discover Daniel Radcliffe's Harry under his covers doing something naughty. No, not that. He's playing with his wand. He's testing out his potency. I mean, look, there's room for sexual suggestiveness because Harry isn't prepubescent anymore, and neither is Radcliffe. He's a gangly English teen, and he's very prickly, the quintessential hormonal adolescent. When a nasty aunt insults his dead parents, Harry can't contain his rage and blows her up like a barrage balloon. And Cuarón doesn't direct the scene for whimsy. He's one step away from some David Cronenberg vision in which she's splattered all over the walls. To have Harry in the hands of a real director is thrilling. Now we're inside this universe, and it's liberating, but also feverish and scary. The palette has changed. The contrasts are higher, the blacks deeper, and Cuarón irises in and out of scenes like some German silent expressionist. Harry is in mortal danger. Sirius Black, a wizard who's supposed to have it in for him, has escaped from the prison Azkaban, and the guards who pursue Black are maybe worse than he is. They're cowled, skeletal creatures called Dementors who suck people's souls out of their bodies. The train ride to Harry's school, Hogwarts, is in a thunderstorm, and even Hermione and Ron, played once more by Emma Watson and Rupert Grint, are spooked.
Let me get this straight. Sirius Black has escaped from Azkaban to come after you.
Yeah.
But they'll catch Black, won't they? I mean, everyone's looking for him. Why are we stopping? He can't be there yet.
What's going on?
Dunno. Maybe we've broken down.
Ouch, Ron, that was my foot.
There's something moving out there. I think someone's coming aboard.
The Dementors who search the train are not quite as bone-chilling as I hoped they'd be, at least compared to Peter Jackson's ringwraiths in Lord of the Rings. But there's a chilling effect when they hover and seem to pull off their victims' faces like taffy. Harry says they make him feel cold, like he'll never be cheerful again, which is a good way of talking about real adolescent depression. And director Cuarón is mindful of these metaphors, so the movie works on more than one level. Well, it isn't gangbusters on the narrative level. Although possibly the best of the books, this is very much a middle chapter. It loses steam in the second half, and there's no climactic wand-off with some ultimate bad guy. Gary Oldman can be terrific, but he's too finicky and small of spirit for Sirius Black, and Michael Gambon, replacing the late Richard Harris as the top wizard Dumbledore, can't resist camping it up. The good additions are the enigmatically lewd David Thewlis as a mysterious professor named Lupin, whose name hints at his secret, and Emma Thompson as a spaced-out, frizzy-haired divination instructor. Even when Prisoner of Azkaban runs down, Cuarón's world is magically alive. Those paintings with their own parallel vaudevillian universe, the giant flying hippogriff with its body of a horse and head of an eagle, the undulating landscape with its lakes like fjords and the occasional whomping willow. There's so much emotion in the filmmaking that this doesn't seem like a synthetic movie universe anymore. It feels real, Hogwarts and all.
David Edelstein is film critic for Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Julian Hertzfeld. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Dave Davies.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Saved is the new film that's part religious satire and part rite of passage, set in an evangelical Christian high school. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Macaulay Culkin, who stars in it, and with director Brian Donnelly. Join us for the next Fresh Air.